this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
This is H.B. Kaltenborn speaking. Here in the nation's capital, there is anxiety and concern, but no outward sign of panic.
And good evening. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight. You're listening to the Cable Radio Network. And tonight's show is being brought to you courtesy of you and the ufologists, those folks down in Palatka, Florida, that are publishing currently one of the funniest and most insightful newsletters presently available anywhere. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have a particularly fascinating show. I have online from Washington, D.C., a gentleman that goes not only back to some of the very earliest days of UFO research in the 50s, but he was also one of the associate directors of NICAP, the National Investigative Committee on Aerial Phenomenon, and worked hand-in-hand with somebody that I have the highest regard for in past UFO research. That's Major Donald Kehoe. My guest this evening is a gentleman by the name of Mr. Richard Hall, and if his name is familiar to you, it should be. He also wrote what I consider to be one of the top books in current UFO research, a book by the name of Uninvited Guests, subtitle, A Documented History of UFO Sightings, Alien Encounters, and Cover-Ups. And joining me now is Mr. Richard Hall. Good evening, Dick.
Hello.
And it's a pleasure having you here this evening.
Thank you very much.
Dick, let's get started right off the get-go here. You were involved with NICAP and with Major Donald Kehoe, a name that perhaps many younger people in the UFO field may not recognize, but yet truly one of the giants that brought legitimacy to a subject that oftentimes is very much clouded in sensationalism and charlatanism. What are your comments about that, Dick?
Well, he certainly was my idol, and he brought me into the subject. He attracted me to come to Washington, D.C., and to get involved in the entire subject, so I'm a great admirer of his, and I still see his widow to this day. I visit her periodically.
Yeah, Major Kehoe unfortunately passed away several years ago. But yet today, even reading his books, and I have all of them, even though they may be between 30 and almost 40 years old, there still is an incredible amount of information in there that I feel is very pertinent, especially in regard to how Kehoe saw the covert involvement of various agencies within our government on this phenomenon. Would you agree with that?
Well, yes, and it has to be recognized that he was the first responsible person to put his neck on the line and say, hey, we're dealing with something very important here, and he thought they were extraterrestrial in origin, and he said so. He was a Naval Academy graduate, a Marine Corps pilot, and he was a government spokesperson in the former Commerce Department aviation branch, which developed into the what we know today as the Federal Aviation Administration. So he was a very prominent person and a very established writer who said, hey, public, take a look at this. This is real. And he started out as a skeptic. So I think it was a very important role in UFO history in that respect.
Well, Dick, you were at the forefront of the effort to obtain congressional hearings on UFOs during the 1960s when you were the assistant director of NICAP. There are many people today that feel that there should be congressional hearings that are held, but yet we see some of the, I guess you could say, the leading lights of ufology are somewhat reticent to attempt that, perhaps because of, unfortunately, all the charlatanism that we have and really the fragmented field. But do you feel that congressional hearings are still a viable option? And if, in fact, we would get hearings, do you think that they would do any more than they did 30-odd years ago?
I think congressional hearings are a viable option, and I would encourage people to write to their representatives in Congress about this, intelligent letters, not ranting, raving letters saying that conclusions, or thinking they know conclusions, but asking them to look into it, I think, would be a very constructive thing to do. Actually, 30 years ago, it did accomplish something. It did put an end to the rather farcical Air Force investigation, farcical in the sense that the Air Force, their heart wasn't really in it. They never really committed the resources to it, and they constantly debunked the subject, and they sort of bottled it up because they legally had the responsibility to investigate it, but they didn't actually do it. But the hearings of some 30 years ago cleared the air about that, and the Air Force dropped out of it. Now that, I suppose, was a sort of a step forward because it was not a military issue to begin with. It was a scientific issue. But since then, there's been a lack of scientific attention that's badly needed.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, my guest this evening, and I'm very privileged to have him here, is Mr. Richard Hall, the former assistant director of NICAP, and just recently retiring from the Congressional Information Service, which was a, or is, a private publishing firm that markets abstracts and indexes of congressional publications. Mr. Hall goes back to the very early days of UFO research, back in the days when there were some very genuine, hardworking, and respected ufologists, although I don't believe that they called them that back then. Mr. Hall is joining us from Washington, D.C., if you would like to speak to him. You can reach us if you're in the 818-213 or 310 area code. We already have a call on our 800 number. Let me take that right now. We have Dave in Yucaipa. Is this video, Dave?
Yeah, it sure is.
Good evening, Dave.
Hey, first of all, Richard, this is Dave Aaron from the UFO Audio Video Clearinghouse.
Yes, sir.
I want the listeners out there to know, Don, that Richard had donated all the NICAP investigations and all the radio shows that NICAP did back in the 50s and 60s to the UFO Clearinghouse, and he did that with just asking us to dub a tape for him, and that he should really be praised for that. So I want to really thank you, Richard.
Well, thank you.
Okay, Dave, did you have any questions?
No, I got a call coming in, Don. I got to go.
Okay. Take care. Okay, Richard, I have a question to ask, and I'm going to have a lot of questions to ask because Kehoe is a personal hero of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the 60s, when the real drive began for congressional hearings, and I'm talking about from all over, not just NICAP, because Lord knows NICAP was trying to get something going for many, many years before it did happen, the congressional hearings, according to all the information and research that I have done, seem to have been spiked at the nub. For example, before the money was allocated for the Condon committee research into the overall UFO question, which I think most knowledgeable ufologists today regard as nothing much more than a $500,000 whitewash, there were hearings held, and there were some people from NICAP involved, but yet it was a prerequisite, and perhaps you can fill us in, it was a prerequisite that no one could criticize the U.S. Air Force at that time.
Yes.
And of course, the Air Force was at the forefront of the debunking and the overall covert nature of the problem.
Yes.
Why did not someone like Kehoe go to the press and blow the lid off that?
Well, he did. As a matter of fact, NICAP held a press conference after the University of Colorado committee, the Condon Report committee, issued their report.
No, I'm not talking about when Condon completed their report. I'm talking about the original congressional hearings.
Sure. Well, at that time, too, we held press conferences at the National Press Club. This kind of thing was not automatic. I mean, we were ridiculed, you know. Maybe in retrospect we look good, but at the time we had an adversarial relationship with the National Press Corps. Believe me, they were very skeptical and very hostile, very difficult to deal with, and I still have some rather bitter memories of certain gentlemen, gentlemen, quote-unquote, in the National Press Corps, whom I consider acted very much less than professionally about the whole thing. So it was a very, very difficult thing to do, but we made a very strong effort to bring this to public attention via the press at that time.
All right. We're going to take a very quick commercial break, And when we come back, Dick, we have some more calls on the line. My guest this evening joining us from Washington, D.C. is Mr. Richard Hall, the former assistant director of NICAP, the National Investigative Committee on Aerial Phenomenon, and just recently, about a month ago, became the chairman for the Fund for UFO Research, which we are going to be also talking more about. The Fund for UFO Research is a very prestigious UFO research organization, which is back in the Washington, Maryland area. And Dick, when we come back, I'd like to also talk about that.
All right, fine.
Okay. Hey, Dick, we have a call from Don in Villa Park, California. Good evening, Don.
Hello.
What cable system are you picking this up on?
Multivision.
I beg your pardon?
Multivision.
Okay. Do you have a question for Mr. Hall?
Yes. I've been interested in UFOs for 40 years, I suppose. And one disturbing incident, actually two incidences, disturbed me. Years ago, a blue fireball was seen flying over an area near Warren, Ohio. And apparently, it left blue residue on a car, a 1956 Ford Sunliner. And it was written up in the Cleveland papers. This gentleman experienced this explosion and a bright light, and he discovered his car was all covered with some blue stuff. And anyway, a friend of mine who owned an airport, which I flew into, said he saw this blue fireball going north at great speed, leaving a blue trail behind it. Anyway, roughly a few months later, it was in 1958, both of these instances were in 1958, probably a few month or so later, or was it before, I'm not sure. A friend of mine was killed in a Beechcraft Bonanza with four people were killed in it, and the headlines of the paper said, CAA puzzled by blue streaks on airplane. A friend of mine in air traffic control...
Where was this crash at, Don?
It was at Medina, Ohio, near Medina, Ohio, in 1958.
All right.
The doctor, anyway, flying this plane. We bought an airplane from him originally, and we knew him quite well. Anyway, the blue residue was on the airplane. Have you heard of any other stories like this who are related to blue fireballs leaving a blue trail? It's possible that his airplane went through a shockwave after near one of these UFOs.
No, that is very new to me. I have been aware of a green fireball phenomenon from the past, and I had a friend in Ohio. That's what I thought you were talking about. Originally, I had a friend in Ohio at the time who saw a green fireball, and it was very odd. Phenomenon. It was not a normal meteor type of thing, but this one, the blue fireball and blue residue, is absolutely new to me. I'm sorry I can't answer.
That's right. I haven't come across any either. I belonged to NICAP at one time. I read a lot about it, and I never heard of any other cases like that.
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely new.
I have another incident. A friend of mine took pictures of two jets chasing two UFOs, supposedly. He said he had this new camera, and he took pictures of these two jets chasing some lights, anyway, and it was during snow was falling, I guess, moderately at that time. And this was probably around 1958 also. Anyway, when we developed the pictures, we looked at the movie pictures on the screen. You could see the objects were white, and they had like a lump on top, mm-hmm. like a conventional flying saucer, I suppose.
Right.
And a blinking red light. I said, oh, you're looking at a rotating beacon maybe from an airplane. He says, no, those things were being chased by the jets, and they were ahead of the jets. I said, let's take a look at this picture, get it closer to the wall. So I pushed the projector closer to the wall, and all of a sudden these small objects turned into much larger objects that looked like a telephone dial with eight holes on it and a center hole with a vertical line going through it and another one with a horizontal line going through it.
Who has those photographs now, Dan?
A friend of mine has it, and his name is Bob. I know who he is anyway, and he's a friend of mine in Warren, Ohio, but he wouldn't let me have a copy of it. He's afraid the Air Force would confiscate the film. It's really unusual.
Well,
and you can see his rotation from frame to frame. You can see these things rotating. And they're really what we see out of focus. They're not what the object looked like, but they're such a sharp object, it looks like another object. It's just like a telephone dial with eight holes and a center hole and a vertical line and a horizontal line.
Would you be willing to have those analyzed today? The Air Force is now totally out of the picture, and that certainly sounds like something worth analyzing.
Well, if I get back home to that area, I'm in California, maybe I'll look them up and see if I can get a copy of it.
Yeah, it's worth a try.
Okay.
Yeah, Don, I would also like to speak to you later on. Would it be possible for you to either give your telephone number to Darren, the engineer here, or to call me at UFO Magazine?
Okay, I'll give my number to him. Call me back.
Okay.
And not tonight, would he be calling back?
Oh, no. It would be sometime during the week.
Okay, fine. I'll give him my number.
Okay, thank you, Don.
Okay, very good.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, Dick, a question that has puzzled me for many years now, having read and reread all of Kehoe's books, and having read and reread your book, Uninvited Guests, one thing that always fascinated me with the various Kehoe books is the fact that he indicated and hinted and sometimes outright stated about the number and types of missing aircraft that were involved with some type of aerial confrontation or chase with these aerial anomalies. I guess today it's becoming somewhat politically incorrect to refer to them as UFOs because people right away want to laugh at it. But regardless of what they turn out to be, how did the people in NICAP act and react to that? And what was being said to folks like yourself and Kehoe off the record? Because I think anybody that's been in a position like I'm in know that you guys had many contacts that were not willing to speak on the record, but yet they would talk to Kehoe off the record.
Yes. Oh, we had any number of confidential sources. I'll answer that. I want to briefly just insert that I was very surprised. This is purely coincidental. I was very surprised to hear about the Eckers and the Ufologist magazine because I had them very highly recommended to me by a colleague, and I have a note about it right on the top of my letterbox. I'm about to write them a letter.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, that's purely coincidental. I had no idea you were going to bring them up. But, yeah, about the whole aircraft accident thing, of course, now in retrospect, we realize and understand that there were lots of covert chases, pursuits of UFOs by military jets, and the whole story of that has never fully come out. We've talked over the years to various interceptor pilots and so forth that had encounters, and Ruppelt, Captain Ruppelt, and the former Project Blue Book spokesman, talks in his book about an encounter where a pilot actually fired on a UFO.
Yes.
And so forth. So, you know, there are probably a lot more of that than we're fully aware of going on at the time. And
well, I guess the crux of the question that I had, Dick, was the indications were that there were quite a few military aircraft that ended up among the missing, never
to
be seen.
That's what I'm suggesting. There probably was a connection.
Do you have any idea what the numbers, even a speculation on what the numbers could have been from, let's say, 51, 52 through 1960?
The numbers of lost aircraft?
Yes, and lost crew and pilots.
No, not really, but I'm aware of a number of cases of it, of course, but no, there was no way to really keep tabs on it. We had strong suspicions at the time, and we had a lot of speculation about it, but we were never really able to pin anything down. There's the famous Kinross Air Force Base case up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Right, and the famous Wellsville case.
Yeah.
I understand there was a case that happened out of Virginia with an entire flight of Marine Corps jets circa 57, 58, or 59 that disappeared in an encounter. Kehoe, I believe, had mentioned something about that. I got more information later from Mr. Leonard Stringfield.
Mm-hmm. Len Stringfield used to report in his newsletter incidences of mysterious plane crashes. I heard recently from a researcher in Ohio who was keeping tabs on the same sort of thing. And it's quite intriguing because, to a certain degree, some of these probably have natural explanations, but it's like the cattle mutilation mystery and a lot of other things. There's a certain percentage of them that are very hard to understand. And you know, there's, on the face of it, an apparent connection with UFOs.
And an element of high strangeness.
Yes, very much so.
Okay, Dick, I'm going to have to take another very quick break, and when we come back, more questions about NICAP, some of the early days of UFO research, and let's then move forward a little bit more and see what's been happening since then. Going to go back, my guest, Mr. Richard Hall. Dick, one thing that many people probably somewhere along the line have heard of, because we certainly covered it a couple of years ago in UFO Magazine, was the famous Armstrong Circle Theater incident where Major Kehoe was on debating a number of individuals from the U.S. Air Force, and during the last part of the program, when he deviated from the script, they censored him, cut his sound off the air, And if nothing else, I think that should have pointed out to the American public that there was, in fact, a covert effort to keep this information secret. Well, how did Kehoe react to that?
Well, that was, of course, a sensation at the time. And at the time, I was at college in New Orleans, and I was listening to the broadcast myself when that happened, and I was quite shocked when it was suddenly cut off the air. He reacted very greatly to that, I thought, and I've since listened to tapes of the whole event where he was interviewed about it. He knew he shouldn't have done what he did because it was a scripted program, but he was frustrated because the script had been sort of dictated by the Air Force representatives, and his role and what he wanted to say kept diminishing, so he tried to ad-lib a statement, and he acknowledged this freely in post-program interviews. It was just one of those very frustrating things. What's important to realize is that a number of people like Captain Edward Ruppelt dropped out of the program because of the way it was being handled, and so did Kenneth Arnold, the pilot who originally coined the phrase flying saucers. He dropped out. He was in New York for the show, but he decided it was too rigged, and he just dropped out, refused to participate in it. So that was quite an interesting event in UFO history.
Okay, we have Jim from Los Angeles. Dick, I think, has a question for you. Good evening, Jim.
Hello, Don. It's Jim from Playa del Rey.
How you doing?
Not too good. I got to tell you, my cable system has stopped carrying CRN.
They have.
So I'm calling blindly. I just caught a little bit of the last bit of discussion, so I'm trying to figure out exactly who our guest is and
okay.
What his area of expertise is.
My guest this evening is Mr. Richard Hall, who is one of the original researchers going all the way back to the days of NICAP. He was an assistant director of the National Investigative Committee on Aerial Phenomenon, worked hand in glove with Major Donald Kehoe, of course, one of the giants of UFO research. Just recently, Mr. Hall has been made the chairman of the Fund for UFO Research back in the Washington, D.C., Maryland area, and he is joining us tonight, giving us the benefit of his expertise.
That's wonderful. It's nice to talk to you, Richard. I'll come up with one question here. Do you see any potential breaks in terms of the government trying to take this research seriously?
Well, as a matter of fact, yes, there is a potential breakthrough in the works because there are efforts being made right now to hold congressional hearings about the Roswell or Corona, New Mexico crash, depending on how people want to refer to it. There have been so many witnesses that have come forth that you can make a very persuasive case that at least one UFO actually crashed and that there was unexplainable debris and probably bodies found there. So there are definite stirrings, and this could definitely lead to some hearings this year.
All right, gentlemen, if I can be for just a second here, if I can put you both on hold, and Dick, I'd like you to finish that thought, but we are at the half hour. We've got to take a break, and we'll be back in just
right.
a moment.
Thank you.
And also on the line with Mr. Hall is Jim from L.A. Okay, I'm sorry that I had to cut you off there, Dick, but go ahead and finish your thought on that. You do feel that it is possible that this year we may once again have congressional interest in this subject.
It is possible that there will be some hearings, and surprisingly, if it goes as planned, they will be open hearings, not closed and secretive hearings. And it's because so many witnesses have come forth in regard to the crash in New Mexico back in 1947. So right now, I would say, well, of course, it all depends on political things. It's still a very embarrassing subject for Congress to take up. But in this case, they're dealing with very credible witnesses and a narrow focus area. What became of the evidence? Where is the report, official report on this case? You know, that kind of thing. So it looks very promising at this time.
Well, with your job, your former job with the Congressional Information Service, and I'm sure, especially with your background with NICAP, Dick, that you had contact with many of these people throughout the years in Congress and the Senate. How do they react to the fact that there are other countries, many other countries, that seem to place much more serious emphasis on this subject. For example, we today have the Commonwealth of Independent States, the former USSR, Russia, the Ukraine, who treat UFO accounts and reports very seriously. We have Belgium, which has not only treated this seriously, but have admitted chasing these unknown objects with their Air Force. We have other countries from around the world that have come to the United States with hat in hand looking for help with this situation. And I'm speaking specifically about certain countries down in South America. For example, the Fort Itapu case, where allegedly one of these things literally, actually attacked a military installation. They have to be aware of this, don't they?
In Congress, I kind of doubt it. There's so much turnover in Congress, and we have there was a especially large turnover during this last election. And the first thing that people would have to understand is that they probably, in general, are not aware of all this international interest. Now, that may be our failing. We should collectively, people in the UFO research field, should make a greater effort to keep them informed of such things. We, the Fund for UFO Research and other groups, of course, are making them aware of things like the Belgian sightings and the interest in the former Soviet Union and China, for that matter, and France and other countries. But this is a gradual educational process, and there are so many things higher on their priority list. The highest things on the priority list of congressmen are what their constituents are saying. So it becomes very crucial. If their constituents want them to take UFOs seriously, their constituents must write them and phone them and talk to them about it in a serious vein. As a serious scientific issue, they will get results.
All right.
I guess perhaps the danger there is not sounding like a fanatic or some kind of a loony to it.
Exactly right. Exactly right, because that's the reputation the subject has. There are a lot of members of Congress who realize that it is not a tabloid subject, but that's the image that it has, and so they have to skirt around that. So a lot of them probably would appreciate in calls and letters from intelligent people, scientifically minded people, urging them to do something about it, because that gives them leverage to work with.
Do you envision that if these particular hearings on Roswell come about, might this lead to further hearings on things like Kecksburg or Bentwaters, anything like that?
That's very conceivable.
I guess that would be kind of the ultimate goal.
Yeah, you have to start somewhere, and this one particularly lends itself to the kind of thing that Congress can deal with because of its narrow focus and the strength of the witnesses and so forth, but it certainly could open up the door for other things, yes.
Okay, Jim, we have some other calls waiting, but for you and for all those folks out there that occasionally encounter problems picking up this show when it's coming over your cable system, if you go to one of your neighborhood electronic stores,
mm-hmm.
you can pick up something called a cable splitter.
Yep.
Okay? And what you do is take the cable off your television set, split it on this cable splitter, run one lead back to the TV, one to your FM receiver. And in the Lancaster area, I believe Video Dave told me before, the show comes out on 1400 FM, but you'll just have to run the dial up and down until you pick up CRM. But the signal is there, even though they may not offer it.
I hate to say it. I tried that last night and came up empty, but I will keep trying.
Give it a shot.
I'm also going to give them a call and write a letter and be rational and see if I can accomplish something.
Give me a call at the office.
I will do that, Don.
Okay.
Thank you, and thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, Dick, we have Ray, who's been patiently waiting from Ventura. Good evening, Ray.
Good evening, Don. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. How about yourself?
Very good. Very good.
You have a question for my guest.
Well, first of all, I think it needs to be said that all of us who are longstanding people interested in the UFO phenomena owe Mr. Hall and Mr. Kehoe a real vote of thanks for all the work they did in the past.
I heartily agree.
Well, thank
I think
you.
They are
nice.
The pioneers of this thing, and I hope that Mr. Hall is really successful with his new venture. It certainly is needed.
Thank you,
I have
sir.
A question
nice.
That I would like to pose to both of you gentlemen. I have some problem in accepting the fact that the UFO phenomena has anything to do with quote-unquote outer space rather than local space. And I attended a lecture sometime recently that the speaker said that there was a valid UFO sighting once every 20 minutes somewhere on the Earth. And I heard an argument from someone in the audience that said if there are that many of these people coming here, they would surely have to drag a planet behind them for food and for energy and for, you know, parking their ship and so on. And the argument went back and forth and back and forth that that wouldn't be necessary. They could get their energy here and so on. So I'd like to just leave that with both of you and get a reaction from you on it.
Okay. Right. Well, Dick, you're the guest, by golly. So how do you respond to that?
Well, I don't know how anybody could come up with a statistic like that about the frequency of sightings, because that's a very difficult thing to trace in the first place. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that sightings are pretty frequent. And would they need their energy, their planets behind them for energy sources and so forth? I don't think so, because this kind of argument assumes that they are very much like us. You know, they have the same kind of energy requirements we do, and we don't know that. They could be something entirely different in their makeup, in their physiology. They may have an entirely different lifespan. In fact, if we take at face value what has been said about the alien beings, quote unquote, they apparently don't have normal digestive systems such as we do.
You're speaking primarily about the Greys?
Well, about the bodies, the alleged bodies that have been found, and the abduction accounts, yes. So I think that's a pretty iffy proposition. I think that's sort of arguing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pen.
I would have to agree with that, Dick, because we really don't know, at least we don't know as civilian researchers, what is really behind this phenomenon. However, let's not for one second lose sight of the fact that apparently this phenomenon has been with humanity practically since humanity began, or perhaps it was here even before Homo sapiens sapien, the human being that we know and recognize today, was here. Going back throughout history, I think that you will find that this phenomenon showed up many, many times, has been written about, accounts have passed down through the ages to us today, coming from ancient Sumeria, from Egypt, from Greece, from Rome. And is it not possible that whatever this is may be, in terms of cosmic distance, a very short way away from us? Or perhaps they could be throughout the solar system. What do you think about that?
Well, I should have added to my original statement that I increasingly speculate, because they can't dignify it by calling it a theory, I increasingly speculate that we might be dealing with beings from another dimension, for lack of a better way of expressing it, beings who live right here amongst us in some sense of the word, and have been with humanity all along. As my friend Ted Blocher, my friend and colleague Ted Blocher, expressed it one time, they come from behind the scenery. That's where they come from.
If I can inject a thought here, I was thinking about what Don said about them having preceded Homo sapiens on Earth, and if you take that theory and read some of Zachariah Sitchin's works, and then take the parallel universe theory, I think you've got a pretty sound basis for a judgment that would leave you feeling a lot more comfortable than that they come from some star system, you know, 1,000 light years away. Or that's an enormous distance. I don't care what you're riding on, you know. But I think those two theories, if they could be called that, would explain an enormous amount of things, like the fact that they could disappear, and the fact that our literature, as far back as we can possibly trace it, has people who have been interfering with us and so on, you know. And the Bible seems to indicate that we were manufactured by someone that was called a god, but, you know, that's just a word. Those two theories would make a lot of sense as far as I'm concerned. They're the one that have brought me the most comfort as far as this phenomenon goes.
Well, Ray, it's funny you should mention Zachariah Sitchin, because he will be on the air with me next week speaking about his brand new book, which just now is coming out, entitled When Time Began. He will be the guest next Sunday evening.
Well, I want to talk to Mr. Sitchin, because I saw him interviewed somewhere about 2 years ago, and he said the title of his next book was going to be The Ending of Time. And well, I want to find out what happened to
maybe,
that
maybe
title.
He got the tail end switched around, Ray.
I'm going to get off of the line here because I'm sure you've got other callers.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Nice talking to you both.
You bet. Thanks. Good evening. Okay, you know, Dick, one of the people that you had mentioned just a little bit ago, who, of course, was one of the major names in UFO research back in the 50s, was Captain Edward J. Ruppelt. And I just recently also reread Ruppelt's book, and I noticed something that must have slipped past me the first time I read it, and I found it kind of disturbing, and I'd like you to clarify it for me. He was somewhat disparaging toward Kehoe, and I got the sense that Ruppelt and Kehoe had a little bit of friction. He seemed to regard Kehoe's research as not being up to his standards. And I don't for one second agree with that. I think Ruppelt, or I think the Kehoe is definitely the giant coming out of the 50s. And I want to find out if you could give a little insight into what that is. I realize that many people may regard that as ancient history. But in order to know where we're going, we have to know where we came from. And, you know, how much longer are we going to have people like yourself available that can shed light on things that happened back in those, I hate to use the term golden days, it sounds hokey, but those golden days of UFO research.
Well, I hope you have me available for a long time, but as for Kehoe and Ruppelt, they had a fairly cordial relationship offline, and probably what was going on there was that Ruppelt represented the Air Force, and Kehoe and myself were thorns in the side of the Air Force at that time. Not deliberately, but they were the people who were bottling up the subject, and we had to focus on them. So they were given a very hard time by NICAP.
No, this was when Ruppelt was out of the Air Force. This was
after. Well, I know, but he still represented the Air Force and the Air Force position and the Air Force story, and he had Air Force people leaning on him. You see, so I'm sure that was a strong factor. But as I say, privately they had very cordial communications.
Well, you know, it's funny, after Ruppelt wrote his book, and he pretty much laid the bones bare on a lot of what actually had been going on behind the scenes, and of course he always maintained his oath of security, but yet then he later, right not too long before he died, came back and changed his book and totally refuted everything that he had written before. And I'm sure that anybody that knows the history of this and have taken the time to read a lot of this information had to have been mystified by that. I was. Do you have any insight on that? Did somebody lay something on him?
Well, that's, of course, what we speculated. It was so blatant that it had to be somebody leaning on him, threatening his pension or something of that nature, because it was a complete reversal of everything he had ever said in his notoriously rewritten final chapter or final section of the book, because you're absolutely right. What you said in the first place, his book was very revealing. It was the first to really show what was really happening inside the Air Force, and it's still, to this day, one of the best books for people to read.
Regardless of what he did at the end of
it? Yes, regardless of that. I mean, it's a very revealing and important book in UFO history.
Okay, I've got to take another commercial break, and we have a gentleman from Florida on the line. My guest this evening is Mr. Richard Hall. Mr. Hall is today the chairman of the Fund for UFO Research out of the Washington, D.C. area. In years past, he was the assistant director of the National Investigation Committee on Aerial Phenomenon, also known as NICAP, was a personal friend and associate of Major Donald Kehoe, of course, who was the director of NICAP. And if you would like to speak to my guest this evening, you with our guest and joining us from Sarianto, Florida, is Carl. Good evening, Carl.
Yeah, hi, Don, and good evening to Mr. Hall. I've got a list of things here.
Okay.
I'm holding in my lap a copy of UFO Evidence, published by NICAP. Mr. Hall knows what that is, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay, I wonder if that could be copied or reprinted. I tell you, there's a friend of mine, Don knows him, Jim Greenan. He has a UFO museum on International Drive in Orlando, Florida. It's tourist place, so if any of you come, you might want to stop there. And I would like to put this in his museum, but I do not want to lose it.
So you're wanting to make a copy of it?
I'd like to make a copy, or wonder if it could be reprinted. I'm sure there's people that would like to have a copy of it.
Well, it was reprinted at one time by the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. I don't know if they still have copies or not.
Okay, I'll check on that.
Yeah, but there wouldn't be any harm in copying it. I mean, making a photocopy of it. There's still copies floating around, but they're getting to be pretty expensive. You can find them in some UFO book services.
Mine's getting a little bit yellow. Mm-hmm. I was a member of NICAP. I've been interested in this since 47. And I have talked to Don once or twice. And I had a little trouble getting through an 800 number, so business is picking up, Don.
Well, I'll tell you what, there are more and more people hearing about UFOs tonight. We've been broadcasting now, Carl, for, as you know, over a year and a half. And we have had some of the finest researchers, investigators, and authors available anywhere on this very show right here. And tonight's guest is certainly no exception.
Yeah, right. He got in on the ground floor almost. Maybe he wasn't born in 1947, I don't know.
Oh, yes, I was.
I was 14 years old and fascinated by it, so I've covered it pretty good.
Uh-huh.
Let me check the list here. Okay, the UFO Museum on International Drive in Orlando, if anybody comes to visit.
No, Jim Greenan, and he's got a real going concern down there.
Yeah, it's picking up. It was a little slow, but... it's picking up now, so I think I'm going to put this down there with him, make sure he keeps it locked up. Okay, the other thing, did you receive the pictures of the skywriting from England yet?
Are you referring to me?
Are you talking to me, or are you talking to
I'm talking to you, Don.
No, I haven't.
They should be very interesting.
Skywriting in England?
Yeah, having to do with a crop circle.
Oh, okay.
You remember?
No. You're going to have to refresh my memory.
Well, evidently, there's been some skywriting along with the crop circle. And I believe you said you had some pictures coming of it.
No, you got me confused with somebody else. I would certainly remember that.
Well, have you heard anything like that?
No, I sure haven't.
Okay, well, I'm an amateur radio operator, and a friend of mine has talked to several people in England. And they have said that there has been writing in the sky that lasts maybe 5 days, similar to that in the crops. And the one amateur he talked to was a farmer, and he had a circle in his field, and he promised to send him some pictures.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what, Carl, if you find anything more about that, I certainly would be interested in hearing about it, but we have got to move along.
Okay, thank you much.
And thank you for calling.
Good night.
Good night. Dick, in your book, Uninvited Guest, A Documented History of UFO Sightings, Alien Encounters, and Cover-Ups, which incidentally I want, this is still in print, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Okay, and I highly recommend this book. Where, if people have an interest in getting this and reading it, where can they reach it at?
Well, it should be available in a lot of bookstores still, but you might have to inquire. In some cases, they might have to order it, or you could get in touch with Aurora Press in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and get copies directly from there.
Okay, that's P.O. Box, let me see, 573 Santa Fe,
New Mexico.
New Mexico.
7504.
Okay. On the page where you have your dedication, and I'm going to read this verbatim. This is after you mentioned Major Donald Kehoe, Ms. Isabel Davis, and Dr. James E. McDonald. And Dr. McDonald is who I want to talk about now. And I'm going to read this verbatim, and I'm quoting, Dr. James E. McDonald, late professor of meteorology and senior physicist at the Institute of Atmospheric Physics, University of Arizona. My role model as a true scientist and also a treasured friend. A truly sweet man, so termed by a New York Times reporter in conversation with me upon learning of McDonald's untimely death. And for anybody out there that do not know who Dr. McDonald was, He was one of the first major scientific people that was not afraid to stand up, be counted, and he upset a lot of people, didn't he, Dick?
Oh, yes, he certainly did. He came to recognize that there was something very important going on, and he was very outspoken about it, and he stomped on a lot of toes in the process.
Well, here's where I'm heading. Now, recently, a number of months ago, I had Mr. Fred Beckman on, who I'm sure you know Beckman.
Yes.
Who was a part of Jacques Vallée's Invisible College, mm-hmm. along with J. Allen Hynek. I tried to get Vallée on the air several times. Every time I called, he was out of the country or doing something else. But in his book, his recent book, that was just published, and I talked to Beckman about this on the air, it was mentioned a number of times. Dr. McDonald was mentioned by Vallée in somewhat less than flattering terms as he related to J. Allen Hynek. Hynek, according to even Vallée, who admitted this in his book, Forbidden Science, stated that he was somewhat reticent about going head-to-head with anybody, and McDonald, I guess you could say, had to have intimidated him because he was not shy about calling Hynek to terms.
Exactly right.
About going out and going head-to-head with these people. In other words, Hynek kind of allowed himself to be pushed around. And what kind of caused me some surprise was the way Vallée himself apparently felt about McDonald. He felt that he was a brash individual that alienated more people than caused to come to the UFO arena.
He's quite wrong on that score.
That's what I wanted to get your opinion.
He's quite wrong on that score. But of course, in my view, he's wrong about a lot of things, but that's a long story. I think McDonald did confront Allen Hynek, and rightly so, because Hynek had misled the scientific community for many, many years about how serious the subject was. Yes, in later years, he formed the Center for UFO Studies and started coming out. Part of that was because McDonald more or less literally pounded on his desk and said, Allen, you've got to speak out about this. You've got to stop playing coy about it. People are being misled. So yes, there was a confrontation there that pretty much helped encourage Hynek to speak out.
All right,
and I can understand why Vallée may not have appreciated that because, he was a big supporter of Hynek's, but something needed to be done. But I know for a fact that McDonald had a tremendous influence in major scientific circles and major political circles, for that matter.
All right, we're going to have to take our half-hour break right now, Dick, but I want to pursue this because I find it fascinating, and I want to get your insight on some things with Hynek. So please, just stand by.
All right.
CRN, the cable radio network, presents this program for its entertainment value only as a service to our listeners. CRN does not endorse or object to any topics or views discussed in the program.